Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. During challenging economic times, people are comforted by having control over the small details of their lives. I talk to people who have rediscovered doing simple things that they haven't been taking the time to do before. Raising food is high on the list, and the benefits of doing it exceeds its economic value. Fresh food raised in an ecological, non-industrial way is always better tasting. Children raised around food production have a very different relationship to, for example, vegetables, because they taste better. We have two guests today who have devoted their lives to raising food using nature as a guide. Join us for this hour as we immerse ourselves in the world of plants, soil, and seasons. First, an editorial about this week's health news by Jeff Fawcett, PhD.
Thank you, Lena. Swine flu is still in the news, although not with the level of panic we experienced 2 weeks ago. Last Friday, the head of the World Health Organization's Global Influenza Program held a news conference in which she discussed, among other things, two groups who seemed to be particularly susceptible. While this is valuable information, it shows how health institutions fail us. The first group of people who have died from swine flu consisted of apparently otherwise healthy young adults. Ordinarily, young adults are not at all susceptible to flu. When pressed by reporters as to why this would be so, the program's director said she had no idea, although in a long response laced with seemingly relevant scientific facts in which she never actually said, "I have no idea." The second group, to no one's surprise, consisted of people with underlying chronic conditions such as asthma, tuberculosis, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. In other words, people whose immune systems were under attack and so were preoccupied with other matters, making them vulnerable to an opportunistic flu virus. It seems to me that an obvious question is to ask is this: what exposure rendered the immune systems of apparently healthy young people incapable of fighting a virus that in more mature adults caused only mild flu symptoms? That these young people were affected might just be a statistical oddity. So few people have actually died that all sorts of odd statistics could pop up. Still, it points to questions that aren't being asked and protections that aren't being pursued. For example, instead of a strategy that calls for stockpiling antiviral pharmaceuticals, why is there no program to support immunity with nutrient-dense food and mandatory no-fault time-off work to rest, which is one of the best things you can do for a flu and at the same time reduce exposing other people? The answer's pretty clear. That's quite literally not how we do the business of healthcare. Last week, a study reported that losing your job puts you at greater risk of getting stress-related illnesses such as diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Remember the pre-existing conditions that put people at higher risk of getting swine flu? This study joins a large body of research on how bad economic times affect health. So, deteriorating social conditions attack the immune system. Environmental exposures also attack the immune system. Just yesterday, I received an advance copy of an article to be published in the journal Pathophysiology regarding the growing body of evidence on the effect of electromagnetic radiation from wireless technologies on the immune system. Essentially, the immune system responds as it would to any other attack. I draw two implications from this. First, while the body is fending off the assault, it's vulnerable to other attacks. Second, the attack creates stress that in turn triggers chronic conditions such as asthma, diabetes, and the rest. Social stressors and environmental stressors attack the immune system, making it vulnerable. The horror story told by public health institutions worldwide about swine flu is that it could explode into a pandemic because people's immune systems haven't developed the antibodies to combat it. This approach ignores the latest research in immunology that suggests that the problem is not lack of antibodies. The immune system actually holds back from producing antibodies and other biochemicals that defend the body. So what the body needs is support in doing what it's already equipped to do quite well. To put things in perspective, of the 10 major things that kill people, the flu is way down at the bottom of the list, which is not a reason to ignore it. But the risk isn't from the virus. The risk is from exposures that compromise your immune system. The health response shouldn't be about antiviral drugs and vaccinations. It should be about stopping the attacks on our immune systems and supporting our capacity for a robust response. But, of course, that's not how we do the business of healthcare. A transcript of this editorial is available on the blog at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett, Ph.D., is an environmental economist, writer, and health educator who produces this show with me and is the primary author of our upcoming book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. Now to today's topic, raising food ecologically all year. And let me introduce our two guests in no particular order. Elliot Coleman, who is author of The Winter Harvest Handbook, among many other books. This is one of many books by Elliot Coleman. He has nearly 40 years' experience in all aspects of organic farming, including field vegetables, greenhouse vegetables, rotation of grazing of cattle and sheep, and range poultry. He's author of The New Organic Grower and Four Season Harvest, and again, as I've said, this new, brand new book, the Winter Harvest Handbook. He has contributed chapters to three scientific books on organic agriculture and has written extensively on the subject since 1975. He also wrote the foreword to Preserving Food Without Freezing or Canning by the Gardeners and Farmers of Terra Vivante. During his careers as a commercial market gardener, the director of agricultural research projects, and as the teacher and lecturer on organic gardening, he has studied, practiced, and perfected his craft. He served for 2 years as the executive director of the International Federation of Organic Agricultural Movements and was an advisor to the U.S. Department of Agriculture during their landmark 1979-80 study, report, and recommendations on organic farming. He's conducted study tours of organic farms, market gardens, orchards, and vineyards in Europe and has successfully combined European ideas with his own to develop and popularize a complete system of tools and equipment for organic vegetable growers, shares that expertise through his lectures and writing, and has served as a tool consultant to a number of companies. And with his wife, Barbara Damrosch, he was the host of the TV series Gardening Naturally on the Learning Channel. He and Barbara presently operate a commercial year-round market garden in addition to horticultural service projects at Four Season Farms in Harborside, Maine. And I see that Barbara has also contributed photos and drawings to this current book, The Winter Harvest Handbook. So welcome to you, Elliot Coleman.
Thank you very much. It's great to be with you.
Toby Hemenway, which is like Hemingway without some of the letters, H-E-M-E-N-W-A-Y. Toby Hemenway is the author of the first major North American book on permaculture, Gaia's Garden, a guide to home-scale permaculture, which we'll be discussing today. He's an adjunct assistant professor at Portland State University. He wrote the foreword for Heather C. Flores' Food Not Lawns, interesting book. After obtaining a degree in biology from Tufts University, Toby worked for many years as a researcher in genetics and immunology, first in academic laboratories, including Harvard and the University of Washington in Seattle, and then at Immunex. Ooh, I bet you're going to have a comment on the editorial we just did, a major medical biotech company. At about the time he was growing dissatisfied with the direction biotechnology was taking, he discovered permaculture, a design approach based on ecological principles that create sustainable landscapes, homes, and workplaces. A career change followed, and Toby and his wife spent 10 years creating a rural permaculture site in southern Oregon. He was associate editor of Permaculture Activist, a journal of ecological design and sustainable culture from 1999 to 2004. His current project is developing urban sustainability resources in Portland, Oregon, where he now lives. He teaches permaculture and consults and lectures on ecological design throughout the country, and his writing has appeared in magazines such as Whole Earth Review, Natural Home, and Kitchen Gardener. His website, I should say, is Pattern Literacy, one word, patternliteracy.com. So welcome to you, Toby Hemenway, which I keep wanting to say Hemingway, Hemenway.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you very much for getting the name right.
I'm trying. I'm going to start with a question to toss out to both of you to kind of set a context for some of the thinking that we're going to be doing here. I noticed, looking at Toby's website, that he wrote an interesting essay about the gloomy predictions forwarded by peak oil activists, where he ponders, or you ponder, I should say, why people need to frame change in terms of suffering and extreme loss. And so I want to say to both of you, it made me wonder whether raising food changes the way farmers and gardeners view life. So maybe, Toby, you want to comment first how that's changed, how the work that you do has changed the way, how it led to you writing this essay.
Yes, well, I think one of the things that a lot of people are worried about is our food supply, and I think there's a very good reason for it. It's not healthy food. It comes from far away, and many other defects that I don't think I need to go into in much detail. But I also think that when people start growing a little bit of their own food, they understand how relatively easy it is compared to a lot of other things that we do that are much more complex, and how incredibly satisfying it is. It completes these cycles. It takes us back to things that human beings have been doing for many, many millennia, and it gives us a sense of renewal. It tunes us in with natural cycles and makes us know that there's a balance of things die down and then things are reborn. And I think that folks who are feeling pessimistic about the future do that in part because we're trained to think just linearly. It's going to get bad and it's never going to change. And when you start gardening and growing food, you realize that everything comes in cycles. And even though it may look bleak at the moment, spring's going to come and things are going to green up again.
Well put. Elliot Coleman, do you want to comment?
Oh, sure. It made me think of a verse from an old poem about peasant living, and I think it went something like this. I farm the soil from which I eat. I dig the well from which I drink. I share creation. Kings could do no more. Anybody who's working with plants and growing food is sharing creation. That's why it's so satisfying. It's just one of the best activities I've ever been involved in, because there's this marvelously impeccably designed natural system out there, and on a daily basis I get to interact with it in pursuit of ever tastier food. I don't think I could find anything more pleasant or more satisfying to do than that.
I like what both of you said very much. You know, I think it speaks to this issue of how nature teaches us about relationships and interdependence, not just in raising food, but in everything, as both of you have said so well. Either one of you, I'd love to hear more about the aspect of relationships in terms of raising food successfully.
Well, the wonderful thing about organic agriculture, at least to anyone who's doing it, and I'm probably the least popular thing to those who wish they could sell us chemicals, is that the world's finest fertilizer, compost, is made for free in your backyard from waste products. I mean, that should almost be illegal in a good capitalist society. And yet, here is the best input you could have for growing is nature's gift to us on a daily basis, and it's being processed by all these magnificent little bacteria, which we can never see, which are there keeping all parts of the earth pure and clean and wonderful. To me, that's the part that I just almost celebrate, sing every day, because nature wants us to be well-fed. Nature wants us to survive. It's our own misunderstanding of that seems to lead us down the wrong paths sometimes.
I will say that living close to nature has taught me something very important, which is that I never feel alone anymore, because there's so much life everywhere. Toby, I'm sure you want to say something. I also note that since Elliot has brought up the issue of compost, you say some very interesting things about compost, including that it's better when it rots in place.
Well, that's just my preferred way of doing it. Or I compost in a regular compost pile too, but one of the things that we look at in permaculture is where we're doing things. And when processes are more intense, like compost is a fairly intensive procedure. You gather it and stage it and turn it and make sure it's watered and all of those sorts of things. But I also like to just compost things right in place, put down a foot or 18 inches of good mulch in a place where I'm going to be growing a garden in a little while, and just let nature take its course, because that's the way that nature composts. So over larger areas, I'll just spread down a big thick layer of mulch and let that decay on its own. But when I'm in a hurry, or when I want to spend more work in things, or when I have a very small space, I'm definitely a big fan of the regular compost pile as well. It just, again, that's what we were talking about with relationships. If it's near to you, if your relationship is something very close to it, you can compost and put a lot of work into it. But if it's a little further away, I might just put down a pile of mulch and let nature do a little bit more of the work.
You're listening to an interview on Your Own Health and Fitness with Toby Heminway and Elliot Coleman. Gaia's Garden is Toby's book, and Elliot's book is The Winter Harvest Handbook, although Elliot Coleman has written many other books as well. And we're discussing raising food ecologically all year long. Toby, the term permaculture actually speaks to interdependence and relationships. Can you explain?
Right, that's really one of its key characteristics. Is when we're designing something, and we design things all the time, even if it's just designing where to put away the groceries in your kitchen, or if it's designing your backyard. But when we design something, it's not the cool things in our design that make it a good design. It's the relationships between one another. Now that's really what design is putting pieces in the right relationship. And that's really one of the basic ideas of permaculture, is figuring out where things go in a way that's going to be ecologically beneficial and save you the most amount of work and save resources and create a really good place for nature to be as well.
Elliot, there are many preassumptions or myths about vegetable growing throughout the year that you've sort of debunked. And the main one would be raising food through the winter in Maine, despite the supposed loss of light. And this is pretty much the premise of the Winter Harvest Handbook. It's sort of, for those of us living in more moderate climates, this is kind of like showing us that it's possible in even extreme situations to continue to raise food all year long.
Yeah, I don't know if we debunked anything. I think we're just too stubborn to give up, so we kept trying and found out that, oh my gosh, look what we can get away with here. Trips to milder climates have impressed me with what's going on there in the middle of winter for us. And back when I was first interested in this, Barbara and I took a trip to Europe in early January, and we were talking to growers in the south of France who happened to be on the exact same parallel of latitude as we are here on the coast of Maine. Basically, Europe is so much further north on the globe than the United States that the city of Portland, Maine, is actually on the same parallel latitude as the sunny Mediterranean beaches of Saint-Tropez and gets the same amount of sun in the winter. And so we're over there talking to these growers, and it's January, and the days are short, and we say to them, well, you know, do you guys have any problem in the winter because the days are short? And all these growers look at us, and they say, what? No, there's no problem with the day length. It's the cold. And at that point, we break into raucous peals of laughter, because what they call cold, we call June. And, you know, these guys have an average January temperature between 40 and 45 degrees, and here it's 21 degrees. Mm-hmm. So anyway, as far as they were concerned, there was plenty enough light. All we had to do was deal with the temperature. And we played around with greenhouses and cold frames and everything like gardeners have for years. And when we just decided to be bold and charge right through the winter, we found that a single layer of covering, like the glass on a cold frame or a plastic hoop structure or anything like that, basically on the East Coast moves the covered area about 500 miles to the south. So instead of being in Maine, I'm in New Jersey. And if you put a second covered layer inside the first one. So a house within a house, all of a sudden the inner house is down in Georgia.
Mm-hmm. And this is without using heaters.
With no heat. And this is just the gift of this bountiful and generous nature I'm speaking about. And you could go on with layers 3 and 4, but at that point you're beginning to cut out probably more and more light. And all the winter salads I love to eat do very well in the winter in Georgia. So if that's what I've created, that's good enough for me.
Well, and then for those of us who are closer to the West Coast, there are people listening all over the world here, but nevertheless, doing a cold greenhouse, which is, like you said, a sort of, you have drawings of various designs in the book for how to do this, is not particularly difficult to create. You can build these pretty easily, and they do not require extra energy beyond the energy that was needed to make the sheet plastic, you know, the stuff that isn't designed to break down immediately in sunlight.
Oh, no, you can make the simplest little structure just with the poles from the woods that you either tie together or put built into a curved shape and run the sheet of plastic over them, and bingo, you're 500 miles to the south.
And do you need to use, you don't use any lights of any sort, so there's no electricity running to this?
No,
that's great.
I figure if all those guys in France getting the same amount of sun we do could do it successfully, all we had to do was put in a couple of layers of plastic to create the Mediterranean, and we were off and running.
Did you find yourself spending a cold afternoon lying around in your cold greenhouse?
Well, it's up to 70, 75 degrees on bright sunny days in January when it may be zero out.
Wow, so that is amazing.
I'm one of the few people working in the soil in Maine in a T-shirt in January. And, of course, since I'm always thinking of the Mediterranean, I suppose I should have a bottle of wine out there, too.
Couldn't hurt. I was very taken by your book and the very specific ideas and suggestions and illustrations and stuff that's in there. It's quite extraordinary, very practical book. And for those of us living in moderate climates, it just makes your mind sort of explode with possibilities. So, Toby, we're seeing a day when water rights and access to water are becoming precious in parts of the developing world because of capitalism and greed. But water is a somewhat limited resource if we're going to continue to have the kind of population that we have. You talk in your book, Gaia's Garden, about water catchment and gray water use and natural purification. It brings up issues about local laws and all sorts of things. You also have information on designing gardens to hold water using a physical design. So I'd like to let you go a bit on about water.
Right. Well, yeah, there's no doubt that water is a limiting factor or an overwhelming factor in an awful lot of landscapes, and it's just going to be more and more of an issue as more and more people in this country live in the West, and for all the reasons that you gave. And so in order to think about water, you know, ecologically and comprehensively, you need to take a multi-pronged approach to it and figure out how to use less water and how to make better use of the water that you have. And someone has done some research showing how much water can be saved just by building up the organic content in your soil. And the numbers are truly staggering, that we could reduce the amount of irrigation that we're doing by 40 or 50% simply by building organic matter up to 1 to 2% of our topsoil. And with chemical farming, that destroys organic matter, so those techniques are right out the window. So right there, just holding the water in your soil through organic matter, it doesn't evaporate when it's in the soil. It's right where you need it, because irrigation is the major use of water for a lot of people in the summertime and for a lot of the world. So you take a multi-pronged approach like that, catch it when it falls out of the sky and reuse it in whatever ways you can. Gray water is an extremely easy and safe way to reuse water, gray water being water from the shower and the laundry, and you can catch it in a bucket in your sink and just pour it on your flower beds and things like that in the yard, or fruit trees, or you can rearrange your plumbing so that the gray water goes directly out into the yard, or it can go out into a bog garden. A constructed wetland is the technical term, but it's just a bog garden that your laundry and sink water goes into, and the plants and the natural bacteria there purify it for you and turn it into much cleaner water, and it wasn't very dirty to begin with. So there are many, many practices that you can use to conserve water and reuse it, and it's nothing to take lightly, because it is really an utterly essential resource for it.
Is it okay to use gray water from your kitchen sink, etc., and bathtub on vegetable plants, or is it better not to because of the soaps?
It really kind of depends on what your tolerance for risk is. There are extremely few examples of people actually getting sick from gray water in their own home. There's some commercial installations where you run the risk of having, you know, people with diseases and things like that. But gray water from your own shower and laundry has an extremely low possibility of making you ill, even if it's used on your vegetables. But if you're a little bit more conservative, then use it on fruit trees and flowers and that sort of thing. Or deliver it directly onto the ground, and you wouldn't want to spray it onto your plants, but just let it flow onto the ground through various methods. It's relatively safe. It's probably no less toxic than a lot of the well water and drinking water that we're being given. It's just different elements in it. But it's come right off of your shower or right off of your laundry. And
so,
the soap is broken down very, very quickly by the living organisms in the soil. They're really good at that. It's very easy for them to break down soaps.
Elliot, do you have some comments on water?
Well, we're fortunate here in New England that it rains quite consistently. And although there is the occasional drought, I think it's amazing what you can get away with, as Toby said, the organic matter in the soil. I think the same volume of organic matter holds 16 times as much moisture as soil or something like that. So when we were first farming here as hippies back in the late 60s, we had no electricity. We had no way to pump water. And what got us through the droughts was plenty of organic matter in the soil. And, again, nature systems, we're supposed to be well-fed. Just pay attention to what she's designed.
That brings up another issue, which is controlling weeds and pests. Healthy farms and gardens tend not to attract as many, both through the use of interplanting with companion plants and various other things. Toby, why don't you comment a bit on the issue of, well, I think one of the problems, too, is that traditional gardens denude the landscape and then water, which is a great way to get weeds to grow. But as you pointed out, what's a weed, too? I mean, I find that I leave a lot of, volunteers, partly because they create a little bit of ground cover under things.
Right. I think the whole idea of really clean cultivation is just creating conditions for weeds to appear. Weeds love disturbance. They love bare ground. They're going to move in if you have bare soil. So the least you can do is mulch. But it's really a good idea to just plant a lot of things so that there's no habitat for weeds to come right into. But also, as you were saying, that many, many weeds are actually edible, and in many cases they have at least as many nutrients in them as the plants in our garden. So it's a little bit hard to call something a weed when you can make a really good salad out of, out of things like chickweed and dandelion greens and purslane and many, many things that people don't like to have in their gardens, but it's great food, full of nutrition. So a lot of it is just designing a garden in a way that's not creating habitat for weeds or not creating habitat for pests. And big blocks of monocultures are wonderful habitat for pest insects. So we try and avoid those sorts of things, too, and mix in flowers and lots of different kinds of plants and things that have strong aromas to them, nicely scented flowers or strong-smelling flowers, and that kind of confuses the pest insects. But again, most insects are beneficial, so creating good insect habitat will bring in mostly beneficial insects, and that'll help keep your pest problems down just as well. So it's, again, it's this thinking about how does nature do it? How can we learn not to create the conditions for these weeds or pests to occur in the first place, instead of creating the conditions and then fighting them when they show up?
Very well said. Yeah, it's also very pretty to grow edible flowers in with gardens, like nasturtiums and other things that also sort of discourage pests like marigolds. They're very pretty, too.
Right. You get another function out of your garden is beauty as well as food.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great thing.
Yeah. We need to take a brief musical break. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're interviewing Elliot Coleman, whose more recent book is The Winter Harvest Handbook, about growing food all year long, and Toby Heminway, author of Gaia's Garden, which is about home-scale permaculture. We're going to just break for a few moments here, and if you stay with us, we will continue with this show about raising food ecologically all year long. Hang tight. Welcome back. There's information about Your Own Health and Fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, CD copies, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. And I might mention here that Toby Heminway has a website. If you could again for us, Toby.
PatternLiteracy.com. Those two words put together is one word, PatternLiteracy.com.
And Elliot, do you have a website as well?
We do. It's Four Season Farm. Season is singular and four is spelled out, FourSeasonFarm.com.
Again, we're talking about raising food ecologically all year long. Partly that aspect comes from Elliot Coleman's book, which has defied the winter cold by creating these energy-efficient cold greenhouses. But in addition, what you sort of lay out, actually both books discuss this, is planting in rotation for year-round produce. So if you could tell us about how when you start different seeds and how that, you know, give us a little bit of an example of flavor for what that, how that works.
Well, for the system we use, we refer to the end of the summer, starting about August 1st, as being the second spring. And in order to have crops that are producing during the cold months of the year in our unheated greenhouses, they have to get established while there's still some warmer and better lit growing months to allow them to get a good root system and get themselves established. And so starting, we plant our famous winter carrots the 1st of August and then on into middle of September. All sorts of green crops are growing in and on later. The carrots we plant the 1st of August, we leave right in the cold ground and slide one of our movable greenhouses over them. And it's amazing. You leave carrots stored in the cold ground with just enough protection to keep them from getting beat up, and they get sweeter by the week. And these are known locally among the children who ask their parents to go buy them as candy carrots, and they are truly magnificent. But it's just a case of figuring out that even a season like winter that you think is inhospitable has all sorts of wonderful delights to offer if you try and figure out what benefits it might have to different crops and which crops might benefit.
So part of this is that you're starting stuff in seeds first, right?
Oh, yeah. We plant everything from seed. Unlike a permaculture operation, this is a pretty much a totally annual plant operation. I mean, there is some asparagus in there. I mean, for us on the East Coast, even artichokes are an annual. I think we're one of the few farms back here that grows large fields of artichokes, but we do it successfully, but we grow them as annuals.
Toby, let's hear your version from a permaculture standpoint of growing food all year round.
Sure. Well, as Elliot mentioned, we in permaculture we often use a lot of perennial plants. I mean, we love annuals, too. I love tomatoes and peppers and all of those things. I certainly have my share of annuals growing, but we use a lot of perennial vegetables. I mean, Elliot mentioned artichokes and asparagus as a couple of the ones that a lot of people are familiar with, but there are perennial collard greens and perennial kale. There's something called sea kale. There's another plant called Good King Henry that's a goosefoot relative. And there are many, many greens in particular that are perennials, and so we can have those growing year-round. And with a little bit of protection, there are a lot of them that will do just fine in pretty cold climates, too. As Elliot advises, under greenhouses and row covers. I also love to let things reseed naturally. Just let a few chard plants or arugula or those sorts of things go to seed, and they'll come up really early in the spring.
Yes.
Nature there is telling me, oh, it's time to start the arugula because the arugula seeds are starting to come up. So those are a couple of strategies that we add in, as well as starting seeds at the appropriate seasons. But perennials and letting things naturally reseed are ways to really increase the growing season and decrease the labor as well.
Do you use cold frames to start your seeds early?
Yes, mm-hmm. I start some inside, and we have little cold frames and things like that as well. So it gives them a real jump on the season.
Toby, one of the things in your book that's particularly compelling is your pictures. There's in both books, there are beautiful, beautiful color photos and illustrations. And in Toby's book, there are pictures of suburban backyards where you've created sort of a forest, including, you know, sometime a little wetland or a creek or something. And the pictures are remarkable because you would never know in a million years that that was in a suburban neighborhood. Is that... I mean, I know that you talk a lot in the book about letting nature do its work so that you don't have to slave at doing this, but this, on the surface of it, looks pretty labor-intensive and maybe expensive, but maybe you can give us some tips.
Sure. Well, we start small, you know, learn, get successful on a small scale before you go out and plant the entire universe, which I've made the mistake of doing a few times, of just getting, you know, on too big a scale. But and go in stages, but you know, it's really do the things that you really enjoy doing. You know, find that your favorite parts of gardening and focus on those. But it is a fair amount of work the first few years, just keeping everything pruned and going and knowing where everything is. I won't lie. I mean, there's definitely a good bit of work involved at first, but then that labor level just drops off precipitously after about 3 years or so. And we have a little saying in permaculture that you plant a couple of fruit trees about 10 feet apart, and by year four or five or so, when everything is really going, and then you hang up a hammock and the designer becomes the recliner at that point.
That makes sense to me, particularly because once you create a little forest, it becomes a different ecosystem, and so there's a certain kind of self-maintenance that takes place.
Right. It just behaves a lot like a natural forest. Your main jobs become pruning and harvesting rather than all the other things that we do. And opening up little edges to let in more light so things don't get dark and gloomy, and make sure you still have room for all your fun-loving annuals and those sorts of things.
Elliot, I note that you have also written about and do mixed land use, so that you incorporate animals into food production in a very ethical and ecological way. Traditionally, the land that you use to graze animals is not the same as the ones that you plant food in, but there's also a kind of symbiotic relationship, you know, like you have chickens that you move around over certain areas and whatnot. So if you could speak a bit about integrating animals into a sustainable model.
Right. Well, for my concept of farming, animals are an important part of the puzzle, a part of the picture. And if you have land that will allow you to use what is sometimes pasture for growing row crops when you want to, you can have practically the perpetual farm. And there's a wonderful old book on my shelf Farming with Green Manures by a delightful old gentleman named Caleb Harlan, which was came out in 1883. And Caleb describes his system out there for a permanent market garden where he had about 5 acres in a grass clover pasture being grazed by animals, and each year he would till up one new acre of it and put that into vegetables for the year, and at the end of the year he'd sow it back to pasture, and meanwhile animals were grazing on the other 4 acres. And what happens when land is in a grass clover pasture for 3 and even better 4 years, it's almost back to the virgin soil state because of the large amount of organic matter and fiber put in there by the roots of the plants and the wonderful biological activity that comes from the animals grazing and the animal manures and everything. So if you wanted to have the perpetual farm, some sort of grazing animals and a rotation like that would be one of the keys to doing it.
You're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman with Jeff Fawcett, PhD. We're doing a show today on raising food ecologically all year long. We're interviewing Elliot Coleman, who you just heard, author of many books. The current one is The Winter Harvest Handbook. And we have Toby Hemingway, who is author of Gaia's Garden. So another thing that's very interesting, Elliot, about your book is it makes you realize that raising some food for cash or barter is not that difficult or not that out of reach for just anybody, really. I mean, just depending on the size of how much land you have to devote. But can you give us some suggestions, you know, for people to sort of consider the possibility that maybe they're going to do that? Do they need to concentrate on only, well, obviously their growing conditions are going to determine partly what they can grow. Any kind of encouragement or thoughts?
Well, the encouragement, you can, I don't know if you see this on the West Coast, but here in New England, during the summer, especially by the time you get into late July, you will see all sorts of driveways with a little box down at the end of the driveway, and they're selling cucumbers or zucchini or whatever they have in excess in their home garden. So this is something that many, many growers, home gardeners, have found out they could do. And then at the farmers markets we go to, there are wonderful people there who maybe specialize in some odd crop, and they're there with taking great joy out of the fact that they are participating as a money-making farmer in this business that is basically at the foundation of human society. So yeah, this can happen. It's easy to happen. And obviously, if there's a crop you like to eat best, well, that's the one you're going to probably get best at growing and want to create the most ideal conditions for. So that would be the logical one to specialize in. And one of my neighbors, one of the small booths at the farmer's market, is a retired gentleman who just has a passion for heirloom tomatoes, and oh my gosh, he has more variety there than you could imagine.
At the end of your book, I note, Elliot, that you had a conversation with your wife about the ideal natural food store, which would contain only real food, no processed foods beyond things that were maybe canned or fermented for storage. And she teased you about how it would be this holier than thou food store.
Oh, yeah, she came up with the name, the WHOLIER, the Holier Than Thou Market, yes.
Although, honestly, I really wish somebody would do what you're talking about. I really do wish for that, although I've noticed that in California there are popping up smaller independent stores that are trying to sell produce locally, and then the farmers markets have become very luxurious and popular here.
Yeah, well, what I've noticed happening over the years, and this happens with any new idea, is that the establishment finally notices that there's something there and get involved and start moving into it. And I think the food co-ops, the stores that began the movement into real food, need to understand this and trying to keep themselves one step ahead by saying, okay, what is better than we have been doing, and what is lengths to which we could go to create magnificent food that the large operations probably aren't going to want to go to, and keep staying out ahead and keep leading us on to a diet of real food. You know, and I say in there that people are complaining because some big operation has bought some organic operation, but for the most part, the ones that get bought up are large-scale operations producing processed food.
Yeah, and please do go off on that a little
bit. Yeah, well, people seem to be concerned about that, and my point is that if they're producing processed food, it doesn't make any difference who owns them. And when the organic Twinkie appears, it isn't going to be important who owns it. It's going to still be non-food. The editorial at the start of this, the gentleman was right on.
Yeah, Jeff Fawcett.
That's the way I farm, and I farmed for all these years. It has nothing to do with only human health. It has to do with plant health and livestock health. If I do my job right here as a farmer, my plants have immune systems, and my livestock have immune systems. And I've never used pesticides in 44 years, not because I oppose them, because there aren't any pests when you do things right. I mean, that's the way nature set the system up. It's only because human beings tend to interpret nature in our own warlike image that we want to go out there and make war on nature. Nature doesn't have a warlike image, thank goodness.
Unless you watch nature programs where various animals are taking down other animals to sort of justify our own...
warlike. That's sort of...
Eating. That's eating.
Eater get eaten. Yeah, well, my lettuces would love to get up and run away from me when I come to get them for dinner, I suppose.
You know that you're laughing, but I remember when I was quite young and I lived at Tassajara, I was given the task of running the garden. It was a very large organic garden that helped to feed the community. And people who talk to me about vegetarianism on moral grounds don't realize how many organisms do sometimes get hurt or killed, or their decisions made, their choices made about who gets to be where on the ground. So there's all of that. So some creatures do, even if it's just insects, do get eliminated. But the other thing was that I will never forget what it felt like to raise food from seeds, lettuces and bok choy and various Chinese cabbages and whatnot, and then be tasked with going out into the garden and harvesting them for the first time. And after coddling and caring for these things in cold frames and then weeding around them and, you know, watering them, all this sort of stuff, go out and take a knife and go whoosh, you know, and cut them down.
Yeah, but Lena, the thing that I'm still high on by the time a harvest comes is the fact that that tiny little seed had the structure within itself to turn into that cabbage or head of lettuce or ear of corn. That's the miracle. I'm still thinking about that.
Right, and it will do it again and again.
That's
and
what
again.
I was going to say.
Mm-hmm. It's just an incredible miracle. You're right.
So, Toby, tell us from your perspective, talk to us a bit about food production and how you see it changing with people producing food in the right way instead of waiting for the government to mandate that it's created the right way.
Right. Well, I think a lot of what's happening just in many, many cities that I've seen and small towns is a huge shift towards local food production and a consciousness that food that's coming from a long distance away it puts us at risk, it's not as healthy, just the whole localization movement. And it's moved beyond just simply growing food to also the lesser processed foods like cheeses and yogurts and breads and all of those things as well. So those are, we were talking earlier about the niches that organic markets need to be looking at, and the boutique cheeses or locally grown artisanal cheeses, things like that are something that can't be beat by one of the giant food manufacturing operations. And it really creates great local flavors. It makes it so much fun to travel and sample the different types of foods that come from the different locales. So that's part of it. And one of the things that I'm seeing a lot of is non-cash-based food systems springing up in cities. There's a fellow here who gardens on 20 different yards in Portland, Oregon. He doesn't own any land, but he gardens on 20 yards that people are letting him use, and he has a community-supported agriculture group of about 24 households that he provides vegetables for. And last year, many of them paid cash, and this year, he's doing work trades with about half of them who are no longer paying him cash. They just come in and do a little work in exchange for their vegetables. So you lose your job, but you can still get a big chunk of your food for free. You're not worried about food stamps or unemployment or that kind of thing running out. You've got food taken care of. So cities can be tremendously productive places of food production. It's just that we don't think of them that way. But these giant office parks and fields that we have around all could be producing great food locally.
There was an article in a Bay Area, California Bay Area newspaper about a young woman in Oakland, California, who rode around on her bicycle and made deals with home gardeners or even people who just had large fruit trees to gather their produce and redistribute it to people who needed it. And this was great for the people who had the yards because they were having all the stuff on the ground. It was being wasted. And she created this whole sort of nonprofit of collecting and redistributing food that was being grown in people's yards without them even self-consciously doing that. So I think there's much more of a consciousness about this, and I do think it comes out of recognizing that when you walk up and down the aisles in the middle of the store in the, you know, huge chain natural food stores where they have various organic cold cereals that are probably less good to eat than the box it came in, that people forget that just because it says it's organic doesn't mean that it's healthful or even natural. Maybe one or both of you would like to go off a little bit about, or caution, not to say that it isn't a good thing that people, that farmers are being held to a higher standard for what kind of farming they do, but their farming is still industrial farming.
Right. I mean, organic farming on anything larger than a market garden scale is still primarily a monoculture. It's using large pieces of equipment and great amounts of inputs that come from off the farm. It's the same mentality. It's an agribusiness just maybe a little bit healthier, a little bit less soil loss, and those sorts of things. But it's not sustainable. It's still fossil fuel based and based on shipping things large distances and big migrant labor pools and all kinds of things like that. It's just that it's better in the sense that it's not using pesticides and those sorts of things. But it's that industrial model again, which we all know is not sustainable or just or equitable model.
In addition, it's important for people to understand that there have been several studies that show that whenever you start eating food without pesticides, no matter what point it is in your life, it still improves your outcome in terms of health. Anytime
well,
you stop.
Well, I think a woman from California who wrote a book, I forget the name of it, but it was a quote in there that I've never forgotten, and talking about this very issue of where organic has become industrialized. And what she said was that we have replicated what we set out to oppose. And I thought it was perfect. And the way you avoid that, of course, is you never think that you're there yet. And that's what's motivated change and advance on this farm for 40-some years. There's always something you can be doing better than you're doing it. So for someone, an industrial operation, they just see, okay, these are the rules, I'm going to meet them. Boy, that's about as low a standard as you can shoot for. And the good growers are the ones who are saying, okay, but I wonder if we did this and we could make it taste better or...
Well, give us some examples.
Grow better. But we work with changing every part of this operation if we see a need for it. And, okay, is there a way we could change the rotation? Gee, I just read a fascinating article on how if brassicas, the cabbage family, follow the onion family, there's some biological benefit because the different bacteria left on the roots of one when it finishes its crop and how that benefits the next. we are researching ecological studies and biological information all the time, just saying, okay, is there some next step here? Is there some minor improvement we could be making so the produce will be even better next year than it was last year?
The big argument, of course, is that due to population demands and due to the number of people who are beginning to expect and demand organic, that there's just a volume issue, so it has to be monoculture. But, Toby, I think the type of gardening that you're professing, which is, I notice you even quote some people from the Occidental Art and Ecology Center, which is just above us. We're actually doing this show out in the woods near there. So we know them. And they're an example of food raised in this biointensive method where you have piles of things growing in different ways and things are mixed together, types of food and rotations, that food production might be still possible, I wonder, or not, do you think? I'm wondering what you think about that argument of, oh, we could never do that. It's fine for small applications, but we have a lot of people to feed.
Well, there are some crops like grains that I think need to be raised on a pretty good size scale, but there are many others where I think the problem is the scale, that as soon as you no longer are either raising food yourself or don't know the people who are raising your food. I'm not saying everybody's got to be a farmer, but I think everybody should know their farmer. And as soon as you lose that connection, nutrition goes down and your own connection to your own food goes down. I think that a tremendous amount of food can be grown on a much smaller scale than it is, simply by using all this land that's available. When I look around suburbia, I see it as thousands upon thousands of mini farms, and perhaps with the economy in the condition that it is and the less and less likelihood that it's ever going to really come back to the way it was, and that's kind of my hope, frankly.
Yeah, me too.
That more people who live out in the suburbs and have a quarter acre or a half acre of land will turn towards not just raising their own food, but taking care of the food needs of other people as well. And that's, you know, it's, in a way, it's going back to that old model of cities being ringed by farms, and they're ringed by suburban farms, and that's the pattern we've lived under for hundreds and perhaps thousands of years, the cities supplied by the farms right around them, so you know your farmer.
It's interesting that we started with the concept of relationship and interdependence in healthy gardens, and it sounds to me as though healthy food production, healthy humans, as Jeff Fawcett's editorial spoke to, and healthy economies are also related to this concept of interdependence. And it strikes me that both of your books, Guy's Garden and the Winter Harvest Handbook, Elliot Coleman, Winter Garden, Winter Harvest, and Toby Hemingway, Guy's Garden, Hemingway, very much speak to this. So I want to thank you both for the work that you're doing and continue to do, and I want to thank you both for spending this time with us. This has been very inspiring. I'm ready to take a break and get out in my garden as soon as I get off the line here with you guys. So thank you so much. Elliot Coleman, the Winter Harvest Handbook, your website again?
FourSeasonFarm.com.
And Toby Hemingway, Gaia's Garden, your website again?
PatternLiteracy.com.
So thank you, both of you, so very, very much.
You're welcome, Lena. It's been a pleasure.
It's my pleasure, Lena. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. There's information about your own health and fitness, our guests, our practice, a free stream of this week's show, CD copies, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org. Our information number is 707-874-2772. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Jeff Fawcett, PhD. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.